This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, we're gathered to share with you our answers to questions that you send to us. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin is here with me. She's our nutritionist in residence. Hi, Layla. How are you?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you. And we're going to get to questions. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions. And we have here, before we get to questions, an interesting study which comes to us from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And I can think of no more mainstream cancer center than the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. You know, actually, it's one of the places where historically they first developed chemotherapy for childhood leukemia.
Oh, really?
And, you know, so, I mean, of course, chemotherapy has a checkered history, but it was virtually invented at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. You know, in the early days, it was unrefined. It was very devastating. It still can be.
Yeah.
But, you know, over the years, it's been refined. And so they usually don't write about nutrients. But the headline here in a news release from last week, high-dose vitamin D shows benefit in patients with advanced colorectal cancer. Now, just before we jump the gun here, let's say what this is not. First of all, this is not a test tube study. This is not a mouse study.
Okay.
The study in patients with advanced cancer.
All right.
On the other hand, this is not a cure. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to cure patients with advanced colorectal cancer.
Yeah.
What they're talking about is delaying progression of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
They said that there were very promising, very, quote, encouraging results of a clinical trial.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the Sunshine Clinical Trial. So they're going to further evaluate the potential benefits of vitamin D supplementation in metastatic colorectal cancer at several hundred sites across the United States later this year.
Okay.
Now, one of those sites, unbeknownst to them, is here, where we treat our patients with cancer with high-dose vitamin D.
Ah.
Right? We've been doing it.
Yes.
Okay. So now, what do they consider high dose? The high dose was 4,000 international units per day, which is really pretty high, but not that high. But they compared 400 international units, which is trivial, to 4,000 international units. And what they found was, first of all the patients with advanced, you know, they're likely to die. They're going to die.
Yeah.
They have advanced metastatic colon cancer, and they've probably been heavily treated. And so a lot of treatments have failed. But what they found was that there was a significant delay before their disease worsened compared to the high-dose group versus the low-dose group. The patients in the high-dose vitamin D group were 36% less likely to have disease progression or death during the follow-up period of 23 months, which is virtually 2 years. So that's nice. Less likely to have disease progression or death. Take that.
Two years.
Like
okay.
Added time.
Mm-hmm.
So they what they did not say, they didn't say that, speak to the issue of survival.
Okay.
They also didn't preclude the possibility that vitamin D could improve survival.
Okay. All right.
Because they said that the study was too small to determine whether those who took high-dose vitamin D experienced improved overall survival.
Yeah.
So there was an improved outcome. You know, this is how, by the way, this is how chemotherapy gets and immunotherapy gets approved. Not on the basis of curing patients of cancer, but in terms of providing them with a longer disease-free interval.
Yeah.
That right there, you know, if you go from disease-free for a year to disease-free for 18 months, you've got a blockbuster drug that could cost, you know, tens and tens and perhaps hundreds of thousands of dollars for annual use.
Yeah.
So that's pretty impressive for something as cheap and ubiquitous as vitamin D. And I think it's very exciting.
That is exciting. I'm glad they're recognizing sunshine.
Now, this is all based on some work done by the Garlands. Mm-hmm. Remember the Garlands? They're brothers. Cedric Garland and his brother, I forget his first name, did some research in the 80s, I think, or the 90s, in which they hypothesized that people in equatorial regions get less colon cancer.
Yes.
And people in
northern latitudes.
Northern latitudes, or very, like, southern New Zealand.
Yeah.
You know, and that there's something about proximity to the equator. Now, you could say, well, people live in proximity to the equator. Maybe they eat a better diet. They have more fresh fruits and vegetables. Maybe they don't use much Western junk. You could say that about some third world countries, but you can't really say that about countries like, I don't know, modern Uruguay or something like that.
Yes.
You know, which is, they eat a lot of Western food. It's quite close to the equator.
Yeah, it's like a mini Europe over
there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so if they do better than the average Scandinavian, suggests that there really is something about sunlight which produces vitamin D.
Yeah.
So that was the first observation with colon cancer. And now we see some interesting results with high-dose vitamin D supplementation. It won't work with 400.
Yeah.
You know, what you get from a multi or from, like, old-fashioned vitamin D.
Right. A quart of milk.
Help. Yeah.
That's 400.
That's 400, right.
Yeah. And that's four glasses of milk.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're going to see an effect with high doses.
Well, that's interesting.
And we could, I mean, theoretically, if they find an effect with this, under very stringent safety measures, they could maybe explore very high dose of vitamin D, you know, like 10,000. You have to be careful with such a high dose, but maybe they'll get even better results,
you
know, if this pans out.
Yeah. That would be exciting.
Yeah.
I'm glad they're looking at it.
Yeah,
yeah. And I'm glad it's...
Dana-Farber.
Yeah, and it's, you and I wouldn't call 4,000 IU a high dose,
no.
but it's a reasonable dose.
Yeah, right.
Which I'm excited about.
Right.
You know, if they were going to say a 1,000 IU,
That could result
it's like
in...
It's not could, using enough glucosamine.
That could result in a headline, vitamin D fails to improve outcomes in colon cancer.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that could be the headline.
Right. Exactly. So
another,
I'm glad they used something
another
reasonable.
Another vitamin debunked.
Yes, yes.
But...
And that's the crime in nutrition research is they don't use dosages high enough to be therapeutic.
Right.
Or to show any kind of outcome.
And same thing with a lot of fish oil studies.
Yeah.
Or fish oil with a placebo, it's olive oil or something like one fish oil capsule versus one olive oil capsule.
But olive oil is already good for us too. It's, so how do you compare?
They're both heart healthy.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Wow. So that's good news.
Yep. All right. So onward, let's tackle some questions.
We've got questions. Actually, we have the same question from both Jean and from Cheryl. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, the fungus Candida auris seems to be deadly and is occurring in different states around the country now in hospitals with patients having weakened immune systems. It's the most serious of the various Candida infections, and different antifungals have not been effective. This is probably due to widespread use of antifungals, antibiotics in agriculture for this drug resistance. But the question is, do natural approaches to bacterial and fungal infections like olive leaf, oregano oil, help in drug resistance infections? And would you suspect that the pathogens would develop resistance to these too?
Right. Great questions.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, what is Candida auris? Candida auris is an unusual species of yeast that is now starting to make its way into hospitals where a lot of patients are very immunosuppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And immunosuppressed patients are very prone to fungal infections. We learned that from the AIDS epidemic where a lot of AIDS patients have gotten fungal infections. Typically where you see fungal infections is people who've had bone marrow transplants or heavy-duty chemotherapy. Very immunosuppressed patients, in olden days, AIDS patients, when we didn't have a very effective treatment. Candida auris is an example of a fungus that is, just like there's a lot of antibiotic resistance among bacteria, Because of the very extensive use of antifungal medication, we're now seeing fungal resistance.
Yeah, yeah.
And we don't have any antifungal medications that seem to combat Candida auris.
Right.
So what are some natural things that suppress fungal growth? Well, mm-hmm.
Oregano.
Garlic.
Garlic. I forget. Yes, garlic.
But I don't know if there have been any clinical trials mm-hmm. looking at that, because I think they're looking at medication solutions rather than natural solutions. But I think it behooves them to consider some of these nutraceuticals.
That's true. It's like with the MRSA infection, or that particular staph infection, that was helped by Manuka honey, as opposed to any other antibiotic that was thrown at the problem.
Right.
And it could be the return to more
Also, sometimes they apply external salves of xylitol to break up the biofilms, you know.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there was very, if you didn't watch 60 Minutes, I don't think, but 60 Minutes had, I think it was this weekend, last weekend, they had a very compelling segment on antimicrobial resistance. Mm-hmm. With bacteria that have become superbugs.
Yeah.
And how this is a huge problem, and it's because they feed the... And they showed a farm in China where they constantly feed a mixture of antibiotics to the poultry.
Mm-hmm.
So the poultry doesn't get sick. But what they'll do is they'll cultivate superbugs and then put them into the environment. And then they went to... I think this was in India. I'm sorry, not China. And then they went to a pharmacy that you can find in Delhi or Calcutta where you can buy anything. Over the counter.
So
people have a cold and they take like Cipro.
Yes.
You know?
Oh my. Yeah.
You know,
they just
if you have the money, you buy the antibiotics because they have this magic aura about them that they're potent medicine.
Yeah.
And it's horrible.
It is. This has to stop. But it has to stop in animal agriculture as well, because that's where, at least in this country, that's where 60% of the antibiotic use is occurring.
What is worrisome is that there's so many very immunosuppressed people in this country now. And, you know, I attribute it, I mean, partly it's due to, you know, poor diet, but it's not just that. It's we're deliberately immunosuppressing tons of people with medications like Humira and Remicade and all these biologics that we use for ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, MS.
Because we're seeing more of these autoimmune
diseases. We're seeing a lot of autoimmune diseases. So these people are sitting ducks for all manner of opportunistic infections. That's why we try so hard to keep our patients off those medications if possible, or if they're on them, wean them off.
Mm-hmm.
We saw a patient today who's on Remicade.
Yes.
And she is very anxious to get off the Remicade if possible. She has psoriatic arthritis, and you know, we'd like to help her do that.
Yes, that would be good. That would be great if we could. So, yeah. There's more and more autoimmunity occurring.
Yes.
And there's more and more reasons for leaky gut, which is the precursor. So it's all very interesting what's happening, and then more people with weakened immune systems, and as a result, and widespread overuse of antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
I think the medical profession needs to get more stringent about, and not just cave to the patient saying, I've got a cold, give me an antibiotic.
And by the way, when you take an antibiotic, it encourages the growth of yeasts.
Yes.
So, I mean...
Here we go.
Just about any woman can tell you that when they take a lot of antibiotics, they'll get a vaginal yeast infection.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So that is maybe part of the problem, too, is that indirectly, use of antibiotics, which don't target fungi, encourage the growth of fungi.
Right.
But I will say this, is I don't think we should panic about Candida auris. I think it's an unusual infection, and I think it's going to be a big problem for hospitals and very immunosuppressed patients. But is it something that's going to, you know, morph into some, you know, a pandemic that's going to affect ordinary walking around people? I think the average person, even if we inoculated them with Candida auris, they would fight it off.
Yes.
You have to be immunosuppressed.
You have to be immunosuppressed. Yeah. Well, another...
I mean, I wouldn't take my chances with an AIDS virus or with an Ebola virus, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that can affect anyone even with a pretty normal immune system.
Right.
But
we are seeing also more and more chronic or intractable urinary tract infection.
Yeah, because...
Especially amongst women.
Right.
And this may have to do with a lot of women eating a whole lot of chicken,
right,
because it's so healthy,
yeah,
chicken. But that's where the antibiotic use may be worse,
right,
than anywhere else.
Yeah, it's thought that if you ingest the
there's
the bacteria,
a strain of E. coli,
right,
that's mm-hmm, mutated,
right,
and just chronically
and not to,
keeps
not to be too graphic
back
about it, is that, you know, one opening is pretty close to the other.
That's
anatomically.
Right. It's the same neighborhood.
And if you colonize your gastrointestinal tract, you can easily colonize the vagina, the genital,
yes,
tract, and your urethra and up in the bladder, and
exactly,
game over.
Game over, exactly. So
it's not actually coming through the bloodstream that these,
no,
bacteria, it's,
no,
through the microbiome,
mm-hmm,
which then affects the perineum, the skin, and then, you know,
yeah,
you're off to the races with an, yeah, antibiotic-resistant UTI.
Yeah. Well, on that note.
On that note. Actually, okay, good point at which to pause, because we want to allow,
oh,
one of our sponsors an opportunity to share a vital message with our audience. So please listen up.
Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as a listener of Intelligent Medicine, you can try a bottle of their finest artisanal olive oil, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. I've been enjoying these harvest fresh olive oils for years. They are far and away the brightest, most lively, and flavorful olive oils I've ever tasted. Their antioxidants and polyphenols are off the charts because they're fresh from the harvest. They make store-bought olive oils taste dull and flat by comparison. Taste for yourself. Check out this generous trial offer and get your $39 bottle for a buck with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now let's get to some of that free stuff.
Free stuff.
More free stuff.
More free stuff. This comes from a Dr. Freed. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I'm a physician, traditionally trained NYU, but I try to keep up.
Me too.
Yeah, NYU, great. Great.
Old school hat.
But
well, I went to Einstein, but then I got my my postgraduate training,
yeah,
at NYU.
So Dr. Freed tries to keep up and incorporate principles of alternative medicine in her practice. She's a longtime listener,
great,
and fan. And what she's looking for are more general guidelines, not designed to specifically treat or cure any disease. But Dr. Hoffman, if you had a food pyramid, what would be your food pyramid? What would be your exercise recommendations?
Let's take the food pyramid and we'll invert it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yes.
Flip it.
Immediately,
right
there.
Cause,
flip it.
Because the base of the pyramid is like
your
bread.
Breads and cereals,
right,
and cereals, all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we flip that, put that into the apex. Like, yeah, occasionally, like, okay, I
mm-hmm,
mean, for special occasions, have a piece of birthday cake or a bagel or something like that.
Yeah.
But don't, yeah, have... You know, eat as if the flour mill had never been invented,
yes,
basically.
Yes, yes, yes.
And, you know, this is actually the source of a great deal of controversy, because a lot of people think it should be fruits, vegetables, and beans that it should be at the base, even if you take grains out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other people who think we should be accentuating protein.
Yeah.
And put that, you know, and by the way, protein in many food pyramids is at that apex. It's like, yeah, you know, okay.
Occasional meat.
Occasional red meat.
Yeah,
yeah. Right. Right.
Well, if seafood is so good for us, why not more? As long as you source it well. I think the bottom of that, yeah, I like at the bottom of the pyramid, or I would mix the first couple of rungs, mm-hmm, with vegetables, protein,
we have
some
something
fruit
called the ancestral food yes. pyramid. And if you Google ancestral food pyramid, mm-hmm. there's a nice graphic of what that looks like.
Yeah.
It's based on the paleo diet. And so it includes lots of fruits and vegetables. I think that's the base.
Mm-hmm.
I think its second tier is animal protein
yeah.
from eggs, meat, fish.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, naturally sourced.
Yes.
Poultry, you know, certainly.
Certainly not, antibiotic
not,
free.
Yeah, antibiotic free and, you know, not, factory farmed and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And then, legumes optional, although some people may mm-hmm. benefit from elimination of legumes because they
yes.
create some intolerances for some people.
And to use natural sugars like honey sparingly,
well, you know,
that
nuts,
would be at the top.
Nuts, I think, should be in the
seeds.
Middle tier, nuts mm-hmm. and seeds, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Vegetable oil should be nowhere on there.
Yeah, nowhere.
Where's dairy? Where do you put dairy?
There's no dairy on an ancestral pyramid.
Right, because how would you get it? Would you, the only way to get it is from your mother.
Right.
And you would not chase a pregnant female mastodon and suckle at the teats of the mastodon in mm-hmm. order to get mastodon milk, right? You know, that would be, you'd probably get gored with the tusks, you know.
Yes.
Right?
So, which really begs the question of does dairy even belong in the human diet? I mean, we're the only animals on the planet.
Well, you know, I think there's something to be said for dairy.
Mm.
Based on ancestral, and maybe we'll be able to determine if there are genetic SNPs that create tolerance or intolerance to dairy. I'm hoping for some advances in nutrigenomics to tell us if dairy is going to be okay for us.
Yeah.
In principle, it's not natural, but it seems that around 20,000, 10,000 years ago, people, especially in Nordic climes and mm-hmm. in Europe, maybe northern parts of China, Eurasia, acquired the ability to digest milk and utilize it as a food. And, you know, human history has been a struggle to acquire nutrition because that gave us bigger brains.
Mm-hmm.
Brains are very expensive from an evolutionary standpoint. They require a lot of energy, and so they better pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And they also require sustained calories.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in order to obtain milk, you have to create domestication, which is a certain amount of societal organization where you take animals that normally produce milk, and then you cultivate them, and you mm-hmm. collect the milk, and you prepare the milk, and ferment the milk, and make it into cheese, and it's a culture.
It's a culture, right.
Humans had to advance to a certain point over millions of years of evolution to the point where it's like, oh, let's try this dairy thing. Maybe we can get some useful calories out of this, and they did.
Yep.
And, you know, did this set people back? Maybe certain populations that had never seen dairy, all of a sudden lots and lots of dairy, especially processed dairy, is introduced.
Yes.
And you add bovine growth factor and, you know, various environmental
pollutants
that are concentrated in there. And that creates problems.
That can create problems, right.
So we were talking about this food pyramid, ideally, where you like the ancestral food pyramid.
Yes. Whole natural foods, the way they're found in nature, the animals you kill, the fish you fish.
And, you know, and it has to be customized because, you know, mm-hmm. we had this question from a patient earlier today. She likes fruits.
Yeah.
Was it today or I don't know when it was. It was today. I can't even keep track. But anyway, she was very encouraged by some detox diet that some guy came out with. And so she went on like a fruit flush kind of thing.
Right. And it's interesting. Neither of us heard of this person.
Right. Right. Ooh. So I'm right.
Yeah.
It's been a long day.
Uh-huh.
I heard a lot of stories.
It was this morning.
Straight. So anyway, she's on this.
Medical intuitive.
It's like, okay, right. Yeah.
Medical intuitive. Person.
So he's written a book and it's about this and she likes it.
She likes it.
But I also note, you know, in looking at her history, that she has a very high insulin.
Yes.
And so she found in that book support and rationalization for mm-hmm. her carbohydrate Jones, her carbohydrate addiction.
Right.
Which I think the fruits ultimately are healthier than candy, but they have to be limited.
But we still have to limit with such a high insulin level.
In her case, individualize it. And
exactly.
in another person who doesn't have that genetics mm-hmm. and maybe a very high level of activity and is of normal weight,
mm-hmm.
maybe they can have fruits galore.
Right. Right. And especially if you're up there putting a roof on a house and the days are longer now and you could do all of that and be more physically active all day long. Yeah, you can make up for all that. Absolutely.
Right.
So, Dr. Fried, thank you for this very
thoughtful
question.
Is that what you're going to be doing this weekend?
Yes.
I hope it's not too
hot.
We're
on the second floor. It's all right. I wear a hat.
That's
all
right. I've done that work. I've done roofing.
You have?
It's one of the dirtiest jobs.
It's
arduous too, because you know you have to also have good balance because it's like on a slope.
Right.
And you have to be careful.
Well, good thing we'll be on a second floor.
Okay.
So we've already got the second floor on, so the roof will be going on via the second floor, because I'm not climbing a ladder more than 9 feet high.
Okay.
My job is HMT. Hold my tape. Hold my tape measure.
For your husband. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, for those of you who are not following the saga of our weekly Q&A with Layla's,
we're building a house.
Yeah. And we'll share with our listeners a picture of this crooked, lopsided house when it gets finalized. It's going to look like the Addams Family house.
Right? Oh, no. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
We've got to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts.
Wow.
And time flies when we're having fun and when we digress. So let's pick it up from part two, but give us a preview of what we're going to be talking about in part two.
I've been diagnosed with gallbladder sludge.
Okay.
Ooh. Oh, my.
So what can be done?
What can be done for gallbladder sludge?
All right. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. We'll be back in just a moment. If you'll stay with us and go to part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast.